Got great ideas, but no idea how to build a website? Get Bluehost. Their AI design tool creates high-quality WordPress sites super fast. Whether you're a blogger, influencer, or launching a side hustle, Bluehost helps boost your growth with built-in marketing and e-commerce tools. Upgrade to cloud to get 100% uptime and 24/7 security to stay online all the time. Why wait? You've got the vision. Make it real. Visit Bluehost.com to get started.
Look at the screen. William Blix, the great red dragon, and the woman clothed in the rays of the sun. Do you see?
I know that I'm not smarter than
you. Then how did you catch me?
You had disadvantages.
What disadvantages?
You're insane.
Do you see?
You're so sly. So am I.
Do you see?
You're supposed to be his friend, Jack. Why didn't you leave him alone?
Do you see? Mrs. Leeds, do you see?
Yes.
You want the scent?
Smell yourself.
Do you see?
Just you and me now, sport.
Do you see?
You've seen these films, haven't you, my man?
You owe me all.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Mindhunter. This is a podcast unpacking, behaviorally profiling, and having one of the greatest procedural detective revelations you could possibly have about Michael Mann's 1986 Manhunter, based on Thomas Harris's Red Dragon. I'm now talking to, he's a One Heat Minute Productions Hall of Famer. He's an author whose new book, for anyone who's listening in Australia, has already been out in our country for like ages. It came out before his most recent book, but now his second to last written book that has now been newly released in America is out and about and finally making the rounds. And it's a terrific book called The Last King of California. His last book before that, everybody knows, is my absolute favorite book of the last couple of years. It's Unputdownable. I've read it 100 times. I think I've bought it 30 times and given it as gifts with a monograph that simply reads, "Read this fucking thing." He's a talent. Nice. He's one of my favorites in the whole world. It's Jordan Harper. Jordan, thank you so much for being here. I wouldn't even think of a Michael Mann project without you, to be brutally honest.
That's what I like to hear. It's great to be here. Thanks for having me, as always. Thank you for giving me the scene that I required. I would have done a different one, but like this was the one that I needed. And
it was funny, this scene. For folks, I've broken the film down, not arbitrarily, but like it sort of fit into kind of nice 24 scenes. And as I was doing it, the next scene is harder. I've kind of taken the mickey with the run up to the conclusion of the film, because it was just almost too hard to like take bits apart that made it really qualitative chunks. But you are so well known, Jordan, that when I even made the table of what the scenes are and what the breakdown was, that like two of our friends that are on this list were like, "Oh, that's Jordan's scene, right?" So I won't even put my name down, because Jordan's going to kick me out of that scene if I say that, right?
Well, I mean, I've gone on the record. I put this on Twitter, at least, that I do think this is the single best mystery reveal scene in the history of the medium. For reasons we'll get into, I don't want to jump to it right away. But I think there's one word. It's unity, because this is a scene in which every single element, from theme to mechanism to character to literally the medium itself, all come together to solve this mystery in a way that it is so brilliant. I literally can't think of a second place that comes close to this as usually the explication of the crime. Yeah. It is a little bit of just mechanical tap dancing that you do. It's why I don't have a lot of truck with like pure mystery novels that take,
they bury the lead on a reveal and you're like, we get it. We know you're like now being intentionally obtuse for a moment. It's not like you're going to another character and pacing out the delivery. You're like, you've kind of, you need to just it's show and tell time, you know?
Sure. I mean, I guess the thing I thought of is my second favorite one would be Tim Curry in Clue.
Oh my God.
But that's just because that's fun.
Speaking of double features, we were talking about it before we started recording. Now that's a double feature. Manhunter into Clue. Manhunter into Clue. Tell you what, vibes would be strong.
The vibes would be strong. Megan and I went and saw it at our wonderful local theater here in Eagle Rock. Vidiots played it a couple of weeks ago. Clue.
Beautiful little theater. The refurb is beautiful. It's beautiful. It was part of my LA tour. I had to see Vidiots.
It's one of my favorite places on earth. I'm currently, I know this will not air in time for this, but I'm currently looking for somebody to go see Shogun Assassin with me on Wednesday. So, you know.
I know a guy, but he'd have to fly and his wife would divorce him. So we'll just move on. We'll just move right along. This is I was trying to think of other mystery reveals. I have a real soft spot. It's not the reveal of the mystery, but I just have a huge soft spot and I know that you are such a huge fan of True Detective. I have a huge soft spot for why green ears.
You're fucking with me. You're fucking with me, right?
No. Why?
No. Oh, I hate that.
Oh, you hate it?
I hate it.
I like that.
I hate. Oh, no, no, no. I'm sorry. This is, we have crossed wires on
really?
This. I literally thought you were funny. I cannot stand that. That's the reveal of that. Have you ever painted a house? You ever painted a house?
I have. My own.
Did you get paint on your ears? Did you get paint on your ears?
No, but I'm not crazy. No. I don't stand on a scaffolding whistling and doing voices. Oh no, I'm all right, ma'am. I'm all right.
I was working on the TV show The Mentalist when True Detective season one, which up to that moment I did like season one of True Detective. and I just remember going into the writer's room on The Mentalist, which was a good CBS procedural, but like was a CBS procedural. And we talked about how if somebody came in with the pitch of the guy had green ears because he was painting his house, we would be laughed out of the writer's room. And so that is where we must part ways.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry we struck a chord. I just have, it's not that, but that's not the overarching reveal. There's so much other stuff, but it just triggers like why that specific thing we don't get to the guy. So it's like a soft reveal. It's not like this. That's just like one little note. I think I would agree with you. If that was the reveal, like he has green ears and therefore blah, like, and like in the next scene you found the guy, that would be annoying, but like in that show, like we kind of have already, we're building up to him. He's hanging around that name, all that stuff. But let's get back to this. It's impossible for me to like stress that how much I agree with you that this is the scene. Cause as you said, unity, so much of Will's stuff is very conceptual to people. And he's trying to explain what this stuff is. And someone like Lecter, who's like a behavioral psychologist, is perfect. They're using like very sometimes complicated speak to talk about what they're talking about. And sort of Jack becomes a translator to normal police. Mm-hmm. And it's like all that stuff has happened. It's just been coursing through his veins and he's getting there. And we're going to just relish in this like, basically, I love the even structure of the scene in the structure of the movie, which is like, okay, we're going to lay it all out. This is everything we absolutely know. Is there any chance that we haven't picked up a connection? And then when he says it, you forget when you're watching it that Francis is watching the family's videos. You forget.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't really even clock that what Francis does in a weird way. Like you kind of know he works at a place that has photography, but that could just be that's how he surveils them. You know, there's all these other things we're going to get into it, but I would have to agree with you. I can't think of another single like mystery that ended so satisfactorily, like where the reveal comes and we know everything.
I mean, I think that's exactly it, but it's just the way that goes up and down the ladder of we see him watching the videos, we see Will watching the videos, Will understands, and therefore we understand that he that the Red Dragon needs to be perceived. He's putting mirrors in their eyes so that they can perceive him, so that he can be perceived. It's all about perception. It's all about film. It's all about being watched. It's weirdly like the closest man I think a De Palma ever get to crossing over is this movie and this scene and this concept of he's watching a tape, we're watching him, Francis is watching himself in the mirror, and it all comes together, and it's all right there. You're right, it's right there. From the beginning, there are these questions that he has that we don't have answers to, but we can. He doesn't ask them because he's watching the same tapes that Francis is watching, and that is. It, I mean, again, I know we're gonna take it apart, but I just think the way, you know, Will looking at this and becoming Francis the way that he has to do, so he has to perceive Francis, and by doing that, he has to also be perceived, and he is being watched by his boss while all of this is happening. And again, we're watching it, and it's got the, you know, the music in this scene is wonderful. We'll get into it. And watching it and taking the time to repeat it and let the audience watch the reveal happen. It's not, it's both a long buildup and a snap moment, which again, we'll get to, but, you know, the fact that the solution to the mystery of this movie is in a movie that is about being watched while we are watching it, and that it all comes together for us in some way that's not like kind of like, you know, abstract or artificial. It is built into the bones of this story. I should have done this myself, but is this a solution to the mystery in the book? I haven't read the book in years.
Yes, it is. It's the tapes.
The fact that man is able to take something that, like, in a book, this is not as perfect a solution. It still works, but it's not this. It's not this perfect thing that we are shown from the beginning, from the first shot of this film. It's shot like the home movie when she sits up and sees him as he's coming in. And then, you know, again,
you're right, but it's all about this harmony, this ending. I mean, I know that you have complicated feelings about the last moments and how that film ends, but just the harmony of Francis meets Reba petting the sedated tiger. They meet petting the sedated tiger. Like, they come to his home. I'm doing homework. There's this unexpected romance. Then Will finds how Francis sees. He like educates himself on the way that Francis sees the world, the distance between. After talking to Lecter, you know, he re-educates himself on how does Francis see the world. And there's that absolutely terrifying. I think it's actually maybe one of the most terrifying images I've ever seen, with the beautiful, languid Leeds mother laying on the bed with the phosphorescent like light coming out of her mouth and her eyes looking in this white thing. And just, it just holds on that so long, and Will's stare at that woman. And then we get Strong as I Am. The Strong as I Am sequence, where like you see objective reality and then you see how Francis perceives objective reality, and you're like, oh shit, Will's onto this. Like, he's actually seeing like this guy. Like, it's a different way of looking at the world. And then there's no more Francis, there's just the Red Dragon, and then we get to here. And so it's such a magnificent harmony of like who Francis is, and like we don't really even see Francis until like 55 minutes into the movie.
And they do such great work of filling that back in.
Yes, you know, backfill. But they don't lose Will. That's the other thing that I think the book, I love that in cinema more, is there's a bit more fluidity between POV jumps, because you can kind of seamlessly go from something into the next, and it's not like a chapter break or something. But that's what I love here. It's just like we get all the Francis stuff that we need, and we do not lose Will's momentum or the case or lack of. It's all just there, and then we get to this, and it's maybe that could be one of the reasons why you're not such a fan of the following scene, is because this is just so damn satisfying.
You know, I know that the scene before me was discussed by your friend of mine, Travis Woods, who's the correct person to discuss that scene. It's such a wonderful, lurid, beautiful scene, and everything you're saying about perception, again, that he... sees the world the way he sees it. While you're talking, it made me think of Inland Empire and the line, I don't want to remember things the way I want to remember things the way I remember them, not the way they are, which is why that character doesn't like videotape. and Francis Dolarhyde can't help but perceive the world incorrectly, but strangely beautifully. I mean, that scene is beautiful.
It's beautiful.
And
it's stunning.
The whatever you want to call it, from his mind, adultery that he sees on the steps is actually his fantasy of it is beautiful, which of course tells us that it's something that he wants, whether he knows it or not.
Yes.
Is that he wants her to betray him because he needs to finish this becoming. And she is actually in her own way in the way of it. The thing about this scene, I brought up Travis for a reason, which is that earlier this week, he and I went to a screening of RoboCop. And I don't know the last time you saw RoboCop. But
it's so good.
Among the many, many, many things that make that a great movie is... And to be fair, it is after he has vanquished the villain. But the movie ends where somebody goes, like, the boss of the company goes, "What's your name, son?" He goes, "It's Murphy." And then a half second later, cut to credits. It's like the moment he says he is Murphy, the movie is over. Yes. The movie's over because that's what the movie has actually been about. You don't need to see him reunite with his partner or... Does he go look for his family? No, probably not. But the moment he says he's Murphy, it's over. I guess you could argue that the scene after this is him reclaiming some kind of lost manhood that he lost when he was assaulted by Lecter. You mm-hmm. could say that. And that is not, to me, the interesting part of Will Graham. To me, it is watching him fully use this thing that he is, which is the person who can perceive and in some ways become the villain the same way that Francis Dolarhyde is becoming by being perceived.
Yeah.
And when he, in this scene, utilizes that power to solve the crime, to me, that's the end of the movie.
Yeah.
The fact that he also has to be a tough guy who takes down the bad guy, that to me is 80s macho bullshit shit that I don't need. That's just not required for me in a story. I don't, you'll know, like, none of my stories ever have
your stories are much more measured about the human experience. I think no one you could never, I'm going to compare you to someone in the way you write and the way they make cinema, and it's a bit of a random one. The filmmaker who made The Seed of the Sacred Fig is a Iranian filmmaker named Mohammad Rasoulof.
Okay.
And his stuff is so unvarnished and urgent. These two things, urgent, unvarnished. Like your stuff is so contemporary that it feels urgent and unvarnished, as in when you take all the elements away, it's just unvarnished. There's heroics and triumphs. They are for the world of fiction. And he feels like much more of a person who's like, no. It's reality. It's dark. It's bleak. We may get relief. We may get reprieve. We may survive, but it doesn't. And especially in that film, if you haven't seen it, it's actually one of my favorites of this year. And I saw someone say you should watch it alongside Rebel Ridge as a double feature, which I'm like, yes. One of them is a 2.5-hour Iranian movie about people being taken to religious tribunals about betraying their faith and being murdered and all of the inner mechanics of that. And the other is just a badass movie, but urgent and unvarnished. I think that this bit does have a little bit of that hero fulfillment, William Peterson to live and die in LA, manifest destiny coming along. But the thing I still do love deeply about it, someone took a screenshot of like that moment that Ralph Wiggum jumps through the window of the Simpsons house.
Yeah.
At first. And it was like Manhunter 1986. I don't know who it was. And I was like, it's just so funny. It was just so funny. And also like when he jumps through the window to like break to do this, I love that he just gets tossed aside by Francis and actually does take like a hail of gunfire from a number of police to like take him down. Cause Will's not going to fight this guy hand to hand. He just rip him apart like he's like ripping a chicken wing off of a roast chicken.
True.
It's so it does have that, but I get where you're coming from.
And you know, again, like I'm being a little unfair, and I'll also admit that part of it is that I just don't really like the song Indigata Divita, and I feel like it breaks the dream in a very real way of this movie, that this movie with this wonderful romantic, like synthy soundtrack, suddenly has this like kind of farty, it's just not for me. And I think that probably, and I should also say that like not all movies that have the good guy beat the bad guy in the end are necessarily macho bullshit. Sometimes that's what it is. I just referenced RoboCop, which needed that moment. But I just, to me, it just feels so tacked on, because the triumph of this film is in the scene we're about to watch, the triumph of his character, the acceptance of who he is. And again, the way that that ties into the theme. And I, again, the way that it goes from the top of the pyramid to the bottom, from theme to literally the medium that we are consuming, all of it is in unity to solve this crime. I've just, I literally, I can't think of a second place. It's to me, it's like, I talk about the interrogation scene in LA Confidential with the multiple interrogation rooms and playing the sounds off each other. And it's just like, what else can compete with that? What else has that kind of juice for an interrogation scene? I can't, to me, those scenes are so special, and my admiration for them comes with a big side of like envy, because I wish I would love to have scenes like that, that I felt were that unified from top to bottom.
They've got the, you know, I've heard someone describe it, they've got, you know, it's probably a more contemporary parlance, but they've got the sauce. It's like those scenes just, that scene's got the sauce. Guy Pearce, we did not know how much your, you know, we did not respect your game enough, but we should have.
Yeah.
He fires out of a cannon out of Priscilla into LA Confidential as Ed Exley and does that scene.
It's true. It's true. And the way that it, again, it works in the book. It's a great scene in the book as well, but that it is a scene that was meant to be filmed in a lot of ways, because you can read about him pulling the switches and how other people can hear it, but film is a much better medium for illustrating that and letting you switch. Like you're saying, you can switch perspective so quickly.
And the multimedia of it all, right? Because you see him touch it, then you can hear it. You hear what he hears. And I love Curtis Hanson's choices about how when he does the switch, it cuts to the POV of the room, and you can kind of sort of hear the clear sound coming from one room to another. And then there's someone going, like one of the guys is like, oh God, why is he saying that?
Yeah. But you can't really hear him.
You can't really hear
him. He's
on
the other side of the glass.
Yeah. It's that, those little touches that make it so special. And then just Russell Crowe just squeezing a chair, just like, and you're just watching wood crumble under his mitts. He's just like, smash.
As I mentioned off air, you know, I saw The Insider last night at the Egyptian, and wonderful movie. Russell Crowe is wonderful in it, but they try so hard to make him look like a, you know, like a chemistry teacher and a scientist. And every once in a while you just go, oh wait, he's like a fucking slab of beef. Like, oh my God, he could rip that guy's head off. He's fucking Russell Crowe. Like he's, yeah, I just remember reading one time about him, his physical training for Bud White. He consulted a trainer. It's like, what should I do? And he's like, well, you're trying to be like a tough guy in the 50s, so just eat steaks and do push-ups. and so that is the physique he has in LA Confidential, is steak and push-ups.
Oh, look, he's all steak and push-ups. That's Russell Crowe. Should be his autobiography. Should be called Steak and Push-Ups. let's dive into this scene. Jordan's one of my favorite people to talk to in the world, so I want to hurry up and get onto this. It takes us sometimes three times of us catching up to get to a recording, and here we are.
Yeah, this is session three of our attempts to record this podcast, but we're doing it now.
We're doing it. Here we go. The steak and push-up sessions. are in. Let's do this.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
So what are we doing?
The dream. He dreams about being wanted and desired. So he changes people into beings who want and desire him.
Changes?
It's a word. Killing and arranging the people to imitate it. And Lecter told me something.
Before we get to Lecter telling him something, 1 hour, 32 minutes, 44 seconds is where this scene starts in the theatrical cut. We'll just let it play about 30 seconds. It's 1 hour, 33 and 11. Speaking of sauce, we use that word. How much sauce does Dennis Farina have to be in the back of this scene and completely blurred and just his voice and just his silhouette almost and just playing off Will's inner turmoil? I love that an actor is like, you're not going to be in close up. It's not a split diopter shot. You are completely blurred, but I need you to be delivering a performance as hard as if you're in close up.
Well, this is where the beauty of the man's mustache comes through, because if you look at his face is actually given more shape than another man's face would be given in out of focus, because the mustache recreates his mouth in a way that really actually makes him, you know, something. And what's great about this, you know, since you've paused, we can talk about just kind of the basic layout. This is a very simple room. This is a box. Yeah. There is a window that we will see Dennis Farina sort of look out at points, and there is a little TV set, and that's sort of it. It is an incredibly sparse area. This is a functional space where all of the things that are going to happen, all of the beauty that's going to come out of it is going to come out of the performance and the music and the great mustache and hair. I'm really liking William Peterson's hair.
His hair's on fire.
And I don't know, I'm sure you talked about this in the scenes. There are times that William Peterson's acting in this movie draws laughter in movie theaters. The talking to himself, which is he makes a choice, and it can jar you a little bit sometimes, the sudden exclamations. And so I really, though, this scene he plays so low, and it's he's talking to himself. He's not talking to some other person that is in himself, which is what you know, I'm gonna get you some, a bitch, or whatever.
Yeah,
whatever he says on the tree. You watched him, didn't you? And again, I hate to, like, you know, I rally against. I hate the easy laughter of modern audiences towards anything that strikes them as sincere or overreaching. But I will just note that it's understandable sometimes in this movie.
You do get it, but it's also, I think people don't want to confront that he's getting excited.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it feels like to me. It's less about being mad and you son of a bitch. And sometimes it is that son of a bitch, but it's that skewering that Hannibal gives him, which is like, you're getting excited. Smell yourself, baby. Like, this is you.
Mm-hmm.
Like, when you're getting excited, he's getting excited because he's back on the scent. He's trying to manifest this moment for so long in this movie, which is why it's so earned. He catches a scent and then it disappears again. He catches it and disappears and catch. And it's all those mounting things that come and like the confluence of all those things come to this moment, all these streams running to here. But yeah, so his performance for me just gets better. I'm just like, it's just better. It's big. He's making choices. It works. All right.
I agree. Let's keep going.
If one does what God does enough times, one will become as God is. You put it together, you get. If our boy imitates being wanted and desired enough times, he believes he will become one who is wanted and desired and accepted. It'll all come true. This started from an abused kid.
I just want to hit pause here, 32 seconds into the 133rd minute. You're exactly right. We've got this little box. It's super functional, but I love the cut. I love that he is obscuring the TV and just these home movies are just playing and playing and playing. And I've said a number of times how gnarly the concept of homework is in this movie, in the series, because like homework is literally watching other people's memories play out, knowing that they've died a horrific, horrible death over and over again.
And it's also a thing that we have watched Francis Dolarhyde do as well. Yes. Like that's the thing again, to build to this idea that this reveal of this mystery is so like deeply knit into this. You have watched the killer watch home movies.
Yeah.
He is watching home movies. He is saying, if you do something enough times, then it becomes true. And he is doing what the killer is doing in order to, without knowing it, in order to have this realization that he must have. And yeah. I mean, again, I know like, because it's not really addressed in the scene, just to like kind of keep talking about like how this is just so baked in. And I'm sure this has come up with other people that, you know, Francis's love interest is blind. She's literally the one person who doesn't perceive him in that way, who doesn't use sight to perceive him. And somehow that removes her from all of this. And it is his marred perception, because if you can't see it all, you also can't see incorrectly.
Yes.
And so she sees in other ways, but like, so that it really is, and what I love about this is, as to your point, the TV is obscured. The fact that this is what they're doing is not probably registering to the audience, because we have seen him, to your point, watching these videos, looking at murder photos, doing this homework over and over again. And the fact that we are sitting in front of the literal explanation for how the crime is going to be solved, and it's just going to come out of this, is, I admire it so much. As just it's exactly what you want to do in a mystery, which is to give the people something that makes complete sense and feels completely natural, and yet they did not think of it.
Yes.
And that is the trick, because you can do, you know, you can do the really obvious ones, and then there will not be a really deep sense of satisfaction. You can do something that is super clever, but a lot of times the audience goes, well, okay, like whatever. that's not that much fun. And then the only joy that you can get is from the novelty of it, you know, the novelty of the solution, which is where you get to some really, again, like I love mystery, but I don't always love mysteries. And just to really, again, like get on my high horse here for just a second, and talk, I think about this a lot, and this is, you know, what I do. What a mystery is all based on the art of the pause between a question being asked and answered. That's it. That's the totality of it. It is all, if a question is asked and then answered instantly, it's not a mystery. That's just a question. If you wait too long, or if you don't do it right, and you break that tension between the question and the answer, then people walk away unsatisfied. It's what people felt at the, anytime a TV show ends season one without revealing the killer, usually yes. you have broken something. And I know I'm talking about like David Lynch, I do think that was a mistake. It's you at least needed to let the audience know that you know. And that's how you, by the way, that's how you get away with like keeping that time, that tension to run for a long time, is you ask little questions and then you give little answers to keep the mystery going while still holding the tension of that first question. Or you let the audience know that a question has been asked and answered in a way that lets them feel reassured. And I think that's where a lot of these shows or things that try and hold the question too long or think that they can get away with not answering it, you know, you just have to understand you've created a bargain with the question. If you're going to do the existentialist, there is no answer, that's okay too. But you should, like, the audience needs to kind of feel that as well. You need to let the audience know that you know that they know, if that makes any sense. Like you have to let them know that it's
It's
not.
not like Lost. I want to repeat that, because you're so it's this is what Jordan does. He says things that like just haunt me because of the how strong striking they are. Mystery fundamentally is, you said, asking a question which creates tension, and then answering that question and choosing how you can stretch the tension between the asking and the answering in a satisfactory way for the audience, and reassuring them that it is going to be answered. The moment you said that, it was like unlocking all of my favorite texts that do mystery well. And it also profoundly was like, oh, that's why people have a weird relationship with Lost still to this day. Like a huge, gargantuan series that asks this massive question and does a real lot of artful stuff with toying with the idea that existentially maybe the answer is not needed for you to have enjoyed it. But there's still that deep thing of like, I need the answer. That's all these black box movies. I need the answer. I need it to be something. And when it's nothing, it's like, oh my God, what a punish. Why did I just watch this? That's what the answer was, you know? Like, whereas in this scene, it's that perfect thing. What is the question? And so deliberately and delicately dangling the potential of answers, or it could be this, you know, as you started saying that, it's like it could be this, and that dissatisfaction of it not feeling right, and it could be this, and in this moment it's like, no, we get the answer. Like all this pontificating over what the answer may be, Michael Mann's just been holding it for 90 minutes in his hand.
Well, that's right. And that's where, you know, to something like Lost, the thing is, if you're not going to answer it, there are ways of doing that too. But the thing that you have to hold is there is in the you have to think about what your audience is feeling, because there's ambiguity, which is beautiful and can raise tension, or it can, you know, be in its own way a catharsis.
Yes.
But that can so easily slip into frustration. And the way that you keep the frustration at bay is you want to let the audience know that question is still out there. You know that there's a question that has been asked and not answered, and they can feel assured that whatever you're giving them is in fact related to the
Building.
fact that the building or leading to something. What you can't feel is like they just fucking forgot about the polar bears or what have you. You know, like that is the thing, you because that is the again, that's why this is it's about the artful tension between asked and answered, because you can break that string can break, and once it breaks, you can't retie it. You have to always be aware it's of how you are supporting that tension. How are you going to keep that bridge? You know, if I can just do every metaphor for like a long thing between two other things. You know, and that is the thing about it. And the thing that's interesting about this scene is the whole movie is how do we catch this guy? They really haven't, the entire film have not had a really good way of doing that. I mean, there are things that get you through the film that you watch. The whole forensic scene, which is also a fantastic, I
Magnificent.
love that scene. And this is very early in the age of forensics, you know. You're so sly, but so am I. Like all of that stuff is fantastic. It doesn't lead anywhere. It does not lead them to this moment.
No.
It is just a thing that you do to keep the audience engaged. You ask this little question again, this little question of here's this note, what does it say? And then we get it. We learn it's a tattler, and it leads us to other things. But this solution, what is beautiful about this solution is there from jump. But it's not, because it's not something external that happens. It is about him, as we're going to see, and we can keep going here. It's about his acceptance of who he is and his doing what needs to be done enough times that he can become Francis Dolarhyde in this moment to understand that he is perceiving this family the same way. And it's both done with like the technical details about the latches and stuff, but also just his becoming the way that Francis has become.
The perfect point to hit play.
Kid, a battered infant. There's something terrible about
What are you
sympathizing with this guy now?
Absolutely. My heart bleeds for him as a child. Someone took a kid and manufactured a monster. At the same time, as an adult, he's irredeemable. He butchers whole families to pursue trivial fantasies. As an adult, someone should blow the sick fuck out of his socks.
Let's stop here. You know, this is a really good, like, kind of dialectic here that he's putting forward of the savage and the little boy.
Yeah.
And his ability to have both of those feelings simultaneously, I think, is really important when you're dealing with evil, which I think we can agree, whatever, we're watching a movie, we can use the word evil. Francis Dolarhyde is evil, but he is also a sad little scared boy. And I think you can do that with any kind of evil that you see is you can hold that empathy. But when it comes to the dealing with the evil of the world, that empathy needs to almost be trivia. It is a piece of the puzzle that he uses in this case to solve it. I think sometimes, if I could again get on my soapbox, it's too much in vogue now, this idea that, the evil are just like you and I, and if you were seeing it from their point of view, you would see them as the hero. And he's pointing out something here that, you know, you have to wrestle with in these things, which is that's not actually true. Like, no. there is a sad little boy here, but there's also something else. And, you know, in my work and my people I think of as like very rich, powerful people who, yes, probably had shitty dads and things like that. But that's trivia in some ways. It's good to hold that in your heart and to know that it's true and to bleed for him.
I bleed for your bad relationship with your shitty parent, because being a parent of young kids, the one thing that I can say about that I observe in real time is that every decision that I make and every choice that I make and every lesson that I try to impart, like, I'm always trying to think of the person, not the current state little person that's in front of me, but the adult that is eventually going to live their own life is what I'm trying to do. And you see how that impacts it, and you see how parents, the way they talk, the way they interact with their kids, you see how, like, You can just see it echoed in little people so much easier. But you're so right. It's like, just because you had a shit dad and now you're rich and powerful doesn't really mean that you can get away with, like, systematic degradation of others forever.
Yeah, denying of health insurance claims, what have you.
Exactly.
But in this realm, just to throw a book recommendation out there, there's a book called The Shrine of Jeffrey Dahmer. And if you want to have this exact feeling for a human being, I really highly recommend you read the book The Shrine of Jeffrey Dahmer, which is one of the saddest books I've ever read. It is drawn mostly off of the therapy sessions that Jeffrey Dahmer did after he confessed. And it is not the descriptions of his childhood that break your heart. It's the descriptions of what he did to people, because and again, I'm not saying that he was a devil in some way. But he was a devil who lived in hell. And when you read about what he did, you understand that this was not done by some, like, slavering demon laughing. You know, this was the act of a profoundly sick and sad and awful person who unfortunately put his sickness and his sadness into the world in a way that was absolutely horrific and it damaged a lot of people. And I think, it's being able to hold both of those things in your heart, where you just can kind of weep for this guy and see how awful it is. And I think the Strong as I Am scene does that in its own way, because you can see that he is lying to himself. But again, like we were saying, he also clearly, some part of him wants to lie to himself because it's happening and because it's beautiful. When he does it, it like the world becomes beautiful. But anyway, I do think that, and again, like, I'm not talking about, impoverished people committing crimes or things like that. We're talking about evil here. And we're talking about myth also, because we're watching a movie. So it's easy to wrestle with it. But even when talking about myth, I'm always going to want to complicate it and problematize it. And that's what I really like, that he is able to, because if he didn't have this sympathy, this mystery would not be solved.
No. And that's the key thing. It's like, I have to live with both truths.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, it's, they're absolutes. It's like, yeah, he deserves to be blown out of his socks. That's no question. But I sympathize. And I think that in art, criticism just in general, when you deal with problematic people, that's another way to approach it. It's like, yeah, I can sympathize with that person having a shitty life. I can empathize and sympathize with their shitty life that did that. But also if they're a piece of shit, they're a piece of shit. And that's just that. It's like, it's both things are true.
Yeah.
Got me thinking about Roman Polanski recently. It's like, he's an amazing filmmaker. He's not a great person. He had some of the most awful shit happen to him, but he's also an awful person who did awful things. They're all true.
Yeah,
all those statements are true.
And then it's up to the individual to decide how they're going to deal with that information. And I don't judge. And this is really going to far afield. I don't judge anybody for. Everybody makes their own choices for those things. You know, I don't watch new Roman Polanski movies, but I will watch Chinatown.
Yeah.
You know, and again, like, don't even need to get into what my particular choices are, because I just think that's my main takeaway after reading the beautiful book Monsters, which I really highly recommend, and other things about this question. And also, by the way, living in Hollywood, where I know how many people are fucking assholes. and the answer, just spoiler alert, is most of them, because this is a system that rewards asshole behaviors. And the same way that if you fucking butchered cattle and left them out back, you'd find a bunch of buzzards. When you build Hollywood the way we built it and you look out back, you're going to find a bunch of buzzards. Oh, yeah. So I know that the odds are, whatever your favorite movie is, one of the big people attached to it was some sort of major asshole, and probably more than one. So everybody has to deal with that on an individual basis, and I'm not into policing either way. Like, you don't ever want to watch, Bill Cosby. Yeah, no, it's weird for me. I can't do it.
Yeah, I can't. I can't do that, but I can't not watch Chinatown again. I'm sorry. There's probably multiple assholes in that movie, to be fair, but one particular major asshole, I still have to watch that movie. It's magnificent.
Yeah. And by the way, now that we're talking about it, maybe the actual second place best reveal of the mystery. It is my sister, my daughter.
It's been staring us in the face.
Yeah, it's really good as well.
Yeah.
What
could show us the worst aspects of humanity? Like, that movie's multiple reveals of just, like, let's just keep digging into the worst aspects of humanity possible.
The script is amazing. The performances are amazing. And it's as good a portrait of America as you're going to get.
From the guy who's currently writing some of the best contemporary portraits of America.
I'm trying.
Compliment that.
Do you think that's a contradiction, Jack? Does this kind of understanding make you uncomfortable?
What about the mirrors?
Before we get to the mirrors, this is the first time in the movie is a really perfect note on a really terrific supporting performance for me, is how weary Jack looks right now. Jack in the entire movie has looked so sharp. He's always on top of it. Even if he's tired, he's got momentum. It's just like there is a metronomic quality to him. Just like, let's go, momentum, forward, let's keep moving. And in this moment, does that contradiction... I love that he doesn't really answer. He just simmers in it. He's just like soaking in it, that contradiction.
Well, you know, that's a good point, because not to be too mechanical about it, but because the structure of this movie is unusual, and we go away from our characters for a little while in a big way, and we're with Francis for that big chunk, what we miss is usually there would be a beat where they admit defeat.
Yes.
We're not going to do this. And then there would be a second beat where they achieve victory. And because we've stepped away from them and we need to do a lot at once, and again, maybe that's why this scene works so well, is we get all of that in one moment. And again, not all films have to obey that kind of super rigid format, but that's what is going on here, is that we are seeing them hit their absolute bottom and then go directly into it in a way that just excises the story and just crams two beats into one.
So great.
He uses the mirrors to see it happen. But he doesn't take anything. There's no souvenirs taken from the houses. He needs souvenirs or trophies to relive the event.
This slow push in is everything.
It's really good. But also, so again, all of this is happening at once. So he's talking about the mirrors. And while he's talking about the mirrors, in the background is the video.
Yes.
And then they cut away from the video at the moment he says he needs trophies.
Yeah.
Because the trophies are on the video. He are now watching Jack watch him watch the videos, which are the solution to the mystery that he is currently posing. And we are watching all of it because, again, this is all taking place at once. We are observing a film. We are a part of the film. It is, and it's the solution, and it's the theme of this whole movie, is about perception and what it means to be perceived and what relationship that has with becoming. I swore I was not going to bring up the mirror stage and Lacan in this, because I think I, but that is, that is so deep into what we are doing here, is the relationship that Lacan puts forward and his theory of the mirror stage, that like a child becomes a human being in many ways the moment they recognize themselves in a mirror. But yeah, very fundamentally to his theory is that that image that the child sees is instantly a lie, because the whole of a human is a lie that is placed on top of a body, and that perception and reality are, it's not just that they're a dialectic. Again, this is a dialectic of the perception is the body, and the body is the person. You know, Lacan gets into a whole thing that, like, when a child sees himself for the first time, he's being held up by a jumper or by hands, and therefore has a perception of himself as being able to stand up, even though he can't. That's getting into the weeds of it. But the point is that the instant that you perceive yourself or are perceived, there is a lie that takes place that is also essentially true, which is what is happening in this scene and what we're watching, and what is the solution to this mystery. It's not even the perception that lets him solve the mystery. It's the accidents, the incorrectness of the perceptions, because it's what is seen here that isn't true. It's about the locks being changed. It's about the dog being whatever, that doesn't work as well as the lock being changed, but it is about the misapprehension that is inherent in being apprehended. It is.
Yes.
And it is all like right here in this shot of the TV and him tilts, and then Jack. And then we're pushing in and we're becoming a part of it, like you said. And it's in that cut, the moment he starts talking about the solution is taken out of our sight.
Yeah.
And when he's talking about the mirrors, the solution is being reflected back to us. It's so well done. It is so good. I would love to hear Michael Mann talk about this scene.
Hopefully on this 70mm 4K upgrade that he spoke about at the screening you were at in LA.
Yes.
Hopefully we get a great commentary track or something, breakdown.
Maybe he records it somehow, so he could see himself accepted over and over and over again.
VTRs, Polaroids, stills, what?
How do I know? How does he find them? We find out how he found them, we'll find him.
There is no connection between the two families. We've done a dozen computer ones.
Jack, all the women have a bloom on them. He didn't win them in a lottery. He picked these women. There's selection and design in his choices.
Love that phrase.
The bloom or their selection and design?
Selection, both phrases. There's a bloom on them. The selection and design.
So Jack has shifted position here. We see the other half of the office for the first time. And I love this backdrop of Chicago that we're getting in through this window, because it almost looks black and white. I don't think it is, but there is something almost like a kind of expressionistic about it in its own way, the way that the top of the Sears Tower there glows and kind of blurs a little bit. And so there's something, I don't know what it's doing, but it's just
the
kind
second
of
time in the movie where Will has had a thought or a revelation, and literally a piece of architecture is manifesting a light bulb. Like, this is the light bulb moment. It's the reinforcing. And right now, 1 hour, 35 minutes, 24 seconds, Will to Jack to the Sears Tower. It's like they are channeling something right now. It's coming. It's coming. I'm desperate to watch it unfold with you.
I just want, before we start, I just want to point something out because of how great it's about to get. Is the scene is also completely dry right now in the soundtrack.
Yes.
Yeah. It is just two men in a room, in a dull room, and now we have moved. We've brought in this element of architecture and also kind of romance and beauty, because it is a beautiful outdoor shot here. Jack is going to be posted up here now, and we still have a straight line between him and William Peterson and the TV. Like the that doesn't change when he moves around the room.
No, it breaks all the rules of like breaking the one, like the 180 degree, like it goes past the TV screen, it moves around, it reorients us, it obscures the lead character, does a lot of rule breaks here, but it's so affecting. It's like it almost has picked the television because that of the importance of the reveal as the anchor point, and it's just pivoting on that anchor. Like, it's like, we're going from here, we're going from here, we're going from here, like we're going from here, and we're moving around, and this is where it ramps up to just be its sensational moment.
Admit we struck out this month. The Learjet is standing by. The basic lab stuff is on it. You, Zeller, Jimmy Price, a photographer. Anywhere he hits, we can be there in an hour and 15 minutes. We get the call, we roll. The scene will be fresh, fresher than we've ever had.
It's not over yet.
Oh, for Christ's sake, it's a foregone conclusion. It's 11:30 p.m. The full moon is happening tonight. Give it up. Forget this month. It's too damn late.
I gave it up. Till you showed up with pictures of two dead families, knowing goddamn well that I'd imagine families 3, 4, 5, and 6, right?
You're fucking right I did, and I do it again!
Great, but don't talk to me about late, pal. I'll tell you when it's too fucking late. Until then, we go as late as I want to take it.
Also perfect that it's in Chicago. I'm just going to pause this scene, because those two guys busting each other's balls like that, you're fucking right, pal, I would do it. It's like the most Chicago shit of all time, and I love it.
It's love true. It. Also, just very brief assumption, because I don't want to overgild the lily. It is pictures of the families that bring him back into this.
Yes.
Yeah. Again, it's just the unity of all of this. It's just so great.
Now we're in the tape.
We're in the tape. This dreamy kind of pixelated tape, and he's.
That's why the bolt cutter.
What's that?
He used a bolt cutter to trim away the branch when he was watching from the woods. Why didn't he use the bolt cutter on the garage door?
Because a deadbolt was there when they were killed.
Donald Jacoby's 12th birthday party was April 14th. Sometime between April 14th and August 1, they changed the lock. But he thought there was a padlock there.
Pause for a second here.
Yeah.
So now we're going double screen. Just to point that out, which is great, because you didn't even know there was a second TV here until this moment.
No.
And
this is a shot and a half, by the way. This is where we've paused at exactly 1 hour and 37 minutes. It's just him in the center, this white chair, the two TVs, the hints at what's happening. Oh my gosh.
And it is like his beginning of the revelation has conjured the second TV.
Yes.
And now there are two TVs set apart like eyes, just to, you know, and from a different kind of mystery architecture, he has now solved it. There's another version of this where he would snap his fingers and say they didn't know about the lock change. He's watched these tapes, let's go. And the fact that that's not what happens here, and we are going to now, the audience feels that the solution is here and he feels it's here, but he has not actually, he's only had that first kind of grasping perception where he can feel something. It's like when you know there's a word and you can't think of it. Like that's where he is in this moment. He's checking everything. And these kind of, again, like kind of rote mystery solution details that he runs through here. This is not the solution to the mystery. No. And it's necessary and it's good and it's fun, but it's not the thing. The thing is still coming.
From the street, you can't see the glass in the Leeds kitchen door. There's a big high fence there, but he was ready with his glass cutter. So either he was casing far ahead and we didn't check back far enough, or we checked.
His eyes, let's just go back like 10 seconds. His,
yeah,
we didn't check, or and his eyes dart between the screens. Duh, 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 duh. It's like three or four beats. One, two, three, bang. He goes, yeah. I just, oh,
no,
this is again, movies. This is movies, guys.
And his, you can see it like the acting like you're thinking is not easy to do. And he does, like you said, it's a really good job, but also. Underneath here, if you can't hear it, if you're not listening loud enough, the music has started, and it is going to swell throughout what happens here as this realization occurs. And you're right, he is thinking and he's moving, and it's just rising. It's I mean, we have to break this to talk about it. It's what we have to do, but it's so hard to call stop because I just want to let it unfold, because that's what's beautiful about the scene is the way it just unfolds and the music rises and his perceptions and character kind of all rise up in the, it's so good. Let's go.
Yeah. It might be the longest unbroken scene where no one's talking, just coming up mm-hmm. right now. Mm.
Metcalf, it's Graham. Is the Leeds and Jacoby stuff still in the storeroom? Have the guard down there call me. Do it. You know that's the Jacoby's cat.
And the music now.
Mm-hmm. You bought a bolt cutter because you thought there was a padlock. Leeds dog doesn't have a collar, but you know it's the Leeds dog, don't you, my man?
He's watching both at once. It's going back and forth, and Jack's watching him.
The bloom on the woman. You can see her again and again anytime you want. Doggy doesn't have a collar, but you know it's the Leeds dog. And the Jacoby cat. And the padlock on the door. And you know you need a bolt cutter and every other goddamn thing. Because everything with you is seeing, isn't it? Your primary sensory intake that makes your dream live is seeing. Reflections, mirrors, images.
Oh,
it's so good.
You've seen these films. Haven't you, my man?
It's so good. I just literally,
I'm my underneath my skin. I've got chills. I'm like,
no, I do too. It's
just like,
it's as good. It's as good as it gets. It's as good. And if you're watching along at home, I mean, you see the moment, where he perceives all of it and it just clicks. And then the music rises even more, but there's just so many things that happen there. And, you know, Jack Crawford is, in that moment, two things. He is exactly the person this is the moment that he was waiting for and counting on.
Yes.
From the very first scene of this movie.
A guy out of retirement who's.
Yes. Yes, exactly that. This is the moment that has been building this whole time. And this to me is the healing that Will Graham has required. That is, you know, as opposed to the physical healing or you know, any kind of need to show physical mastery. It is that he is complete in his ability that begins in the scene when he confesses complete sympathy for this man who he must stop. And then we just watch it unfold. It's like watching a flower bloom, yeah, in stop motion, you know, it's, or time lapse, I mean. And there's, so, you know, you're watching him put it all together, and then it cuts to Jack Crawford, who is, like I said, both having his own personal mission for this movie be fulfilled, because he knew this is what would happen the moment that he put Will in, that this was what had to get here. But he also is the audience, and we are watching him. He is watching Will. He is, you can see on his face, it's a great piece of like a very subtle acting, that he is watching a man fucking cook, you know, he is watching, he's watching greatness. He is watching, and it's such a weird, sick form of greatness. And he is, again, I feel like I've made this point plenty, but he is watching Will watch the videos, have a revelation about watching and being watched. And in a weird way, by watching these movies and having this realization, he sees Francis completely clearly. And yet there's almost a feeling that somehow that also means Francis is seeing him. I know that, yes, doesn't really make sense, but it's there that because he talks to him in that moment. It's like, oh, he is here with us. He has been
seen
here
these
with
films,
us.
Haven't you? And this yeah, shot, this exact shot where we've paused, 1 hour, 39 minutes, 15 seconds, when he stands up and the bloom of the televisions is on his face, he goes, you've seen these films, mm, haven't you, my man? And they're as close. We're intimate now with Will. We're as close to Francis. He's calling us out of the scene. It's all been very insular in this moment. This, haven't you, my man, is him talking to Francis. He's throwing something out into the ether. And it's just a special, special scene. And the cut to close up here. And then, yeah, this run up is just, the conclusion is just everything.
I mean, I know, it's obviously, this is my favorite scene in this movie. It might be my favorite Michael Mann scene. It might, yeah, be my favorite scene. I don't know. It's so good. It is. It is, from my perspective as somebody who crafts things, the craft of it is just, very rarely do things like theme and meaning and story architecture and medium come together this way. It's really special, and it's really, really hard. And I don't know where in the process Michael Mann realized how perfect this scene was for cinema, and how much better it is for cinema than it was in the book. But it's just all there. It's amazing.
It's all there.
It's the gardener's storeroom.
Cans.
What cans?
The tapes were transferred from Home Movies. Where's the packaging the films came from?
There's films of the families in the document storage. Find them.
Oh, look at this framing. 1 hour, 39 minutes, 32 seconds. Jack's talking on the phone to the guy. The tower's right there. The light bulb is on. It's gleaming at the top of the seat. It's gleaming.
It's gleaming. And also, I'll point out, when Jack was standing in this window, you could not see his reflection coming, yeah, back at him. You can't see it here. You can see Will's reflection. He is looking at himself, but it's a shadow self. And what's about to happen, so we don't even have to stop for it, is he is saying that the addresses are going to be, for the film lab, are going to be identical. And there is a moment where Jack says they're not identical. And the reason that happens for story purposes is because to show how confident Will is, because he is not thrown back at all. Yeah. He is so sure of himself that he instantly puts together what has happened. It does. The fact that he gets a negative feedback on this just means that he needs to go one layer deeper. It doesn't even slow him down. He is, if you've ever taken just the right amount of mushrooms, you know what this feels like. It is when he is walking through the raindrops at this point. He is not getting wet.
You got him? Are there any labels? Leeds Can, Gateway Lab, St. Louis, Missouri.
The Jacoby label will say the same thing as the Leeds label. Gateway Labs, St. Louis, Missouri.
Who processed the Jacoby film? No. Bob's Photo Store, Birmingham.
Stores send them out. Have him peel the top label back.
Is there a label underneath?
He doesn't even pause.
Yeah. The hand touches the window.
does, doesn't it?
That reaction shot from Farina. It does,
he's
doesn't
blown
it?
Away.
He just looks, and the music's gone.
Yeah, because it's over. It's over now.
Yeah, it's done.
And again, if this was RoboCop, you could smash cut to Manhunter and just play the theme. And because you know, they're gonna get him. They're gonna rescue the girl.
If Reba wasn't in peril, it literally could have gone smash cut.
Well, and that's sort of, yes, it is interesting because not to get too in the weeds here, but the thing that they think is about to happen, which is that Francis Dolarhyde is going to go out and kill a victim tonight, is in fact not going to happen.
No.
And I guess one is to, because he's clearly searching for new victims. We see that in the scene where he's watching other home movies, that Reeva's going to become a stand-in for his usual house hunting victim.
Yes.
Tonight, right? That so normally that this attempt to like run to the house would be fruitless because he would be out in another city killing people.
Yeah.
It's also worth pointing out, this is where wrapping up on a much less profound, this solution to this mystery, which involves people owning film cameras to record home video, which they then send to be processed and put on tape, is a solution that you could only have in about a 2-year window.
Yes, it really is. It really is. Because you get the VHS tapes, you get the old Betamax little tapes that you plug it into the larger exterior VHS cassette to like play the home movie that you've shot. Like having something on film that gets processed back to tape, you are so right. It is a very, very brief window.
Yeah. And it's always hard to remember these moments where we're in the future now, that in this film, this is all cutting edge. Like, just like the forensics that they use, it's all just absolute cutting edge. And it just doesn't feel that way to us because it's old to us. But like, this is a very technological, it would be like coming up with an Instagram solution for a mystery in a way that was somehow profound and said something about perception, humanity, which I guess maybe I could set myself to trying to do.
Yeah, I mean, if there's anyone in the world that's going to do it, it's you.
I try.
I want a chopper on the roof in 3 minutes to Meg's Field. At Meg's Field, I want the Learjet prepped and a...
I love Jack just doing his thing. Will's reflection gets caught in the window. I just wanted to play this out so that we could finish up. And then we're at Francis's creepy as all hell home in Missouri.
Yeah. As somebody who just came back from St. Louis, there's not a lot of St. Louis vibes in anything they do. And in this movie, other than that they fly into Lambert, which was at the time a hub airport, it is no longer. The Lambert International Airport is a sad shell ever since TWA went out of business at this point decades ago. But they don't eat toasted ravioli or have St. Louis style pizza or watch a Cardinals game. And,
come on.
Drink beer in a diner, which I think of as being a very kind of the St. Louis thing. I guess there are other places where they serve beer and diner.
That I want to do. Drink beer in a diner with you, watch a Cardinals game, eat toasted ravioli. I'm like, yes.
Gooey butter cake. You can get in on it. You know?
God, gooey butter cake. What the hell? What kind of sorcery are you guys cooking over there in Missouri?
I mean, they die young down there. I will say I didn't have any gooey butter cake, but I did have St. Louis style pizza and toasted ravioli while I was in St. Louis recently. It is pretty fantastic. I guess the other piece of St. Louis, since this is called Gateway Labs, and that is representative of the St. Louis Arch Gateway to the West. So there you go.
There you go. And also, I can confirm that Jordan Harper is someone who will never see you wrong at a diner choice. And I'm like, Jordan, what should I eat? And he's like, get this. I'll sort you out. Mm. I got you covered.
It's true. I know what to eat.
He knows what
to eat. I'm going to die young too.
We're going to go to Bob's Big Boy and drink coffee like David Lynch and gigantic milkshakes.
Those milkshakes. I for people at home, they don't understand. You might not know this, but Blake's Australian. And so when I surprised him in America while he was here in LA, I surprised Bob's Big Boy, where he was somewhat surprised to see me and then absolutely gobsmacked to see the size of the milkshakes that they serve, where they bring you, he didn't understand the concept of the silver cup, where they just bring you a second milkshake with your milkshake. And
yeah,
I was like, yeah, again, you think that's come to the Midwest with me sometime. It's I would love that. My usual drinking glass here, I always have a Shakespeare's pizza, which is Columbia, Missouri's college town pizza place that I love, which I also stopped at my recent trip to Missouri. But a thing they do in the Midwest, much like the silver cups, is if you let your soft drink get below half mast, they bring you a second one. They don't ask. They don't refill your cup. They just put a second large glass of soda next to your glass of soda. And you literally have to kind of beg them to stop doing that. It's like, please, I will, if you put it in front of me, I will drink it. So please stop bringing me Diet Cokes.
I grew up like that because when I grew up, we weren't, you know, we were quite lucky. Some of our family were very well off, like as it happens in families, you know, certain members of your family are quite well off, and we're in the sort of not well off strata. And like, I've got that like poor kid energy. If like, if you put it on in front of me, I want to eat to show you like that I'm grateful.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why America is just diabolical to me in some of those respects. Cause I'm like, if you put it here, I want to eat it to show you that it's good. It's like psychologically baked into my brain. And when we were there and there were two giant milkshakes and I was like, I think I need a soda. And they did the same thing with the soda. They just kept topping up the soda. I was like, I can't. I got to get out of here.
No. Okay. It's deadly. It's deadly, man. The all you can eat buffet.
You only said one lie there, which is that I think my surprise at you coming in there was a little bit bigger and crazier. I did probably scare half of the diners because I just saw a figure come up and I thought someone was coming to take our order. And there's Jordan Harper, not a server. And I freaked out and it was great. It was excellent.
It was very fun. That was a great trip. I'm glad you were able to come down here.
Oh, it was
come
best.
Back.
I'm working.
Bring Sam next time. Bring Sam.
I am.
Then she can't get mad at you.
Yeah, that's exactly the plan. That's exactly the plan. How do we make it happen as a family so that we can all be there for a little bit longer? That would be amazing. Man, thank you so much for doing this. This was a special scene. I've been looking forward to it so much, and even more looking forward to it because I get to talk to you. So I'm going to go back and listen to this because you're in a special time right now. I can't wait to read. I mean, look, everybody needs to know that everybody knows in The Last King of California, and obviously She Rides Shotgun, read Jordan's novels. They're absolutely amazing. They're genuinely just the best, and he's the best. And yeah, like it's a pretty crazy thing that one S.A. Cosby all the way back on like the third episode of this show is like, Blake, you know, I'm only doing this scene because bloody Jordan Harper got his mitts on that scene. And I'm like, bro, I love you. I know, like I'm choosing between two of America's great crime authors, but he got in there first, man. He got in there first.
Sean had to give me this one. This is one
I think anyone listening is going to understand why I was like, no, Jordan Harper has a mortgage on this scene, everyone. It's over. Stop. You're the best. I appreciate
you're
you
the best,
much.
Man.
Thank you so much for doing this. This is so much fun. Guys, thanks for listening. Better. This is the best. Latest Michael Mann deep dive at One Heat Minute Productions. Thank you so much for listening. If you want to check out other deep dive series we've done on Michael Mann, go over to oneheatminute.com. You can find links to all of our previous shows, including One Heat Minute, The Last 12 Minutes of the Mohicans, Miami Nice, featuring Katie Walsh and I, and all modern man movies, including Collateral, Ferrari, Black Hat, you name it, it is there. And the Jimmy Kahn Eulogy, One Thief Minute. Plenty of shows over there. If
you want to support everything that we do, we'd greatly appreciate if you checked out our Patreon /One Heat Minute. Over there, you can see weekly new releases. One Hot Take is the show there. You can also see The Decade Project, where we look back 10 years on the films that are still hanging around, currently working through 2014. They'll be on the main feed at the end of the year, but if you are a patron for as little as $1 a month, you're getting them all throughout the year. And most importantly, as this is a Min Hunter episode, Min Hunter video podcasts will be popping up. Not every single episode, but most episodes will pop up as a video podcast as a drop there, so you can watch and consume and see all of the frames and images that we're talking about in all of these episodes. Every little bit of your support helps. So sharing, talking to us online at OHM Pods or for myself at One Blake Minute on Instagram and Twitter. Thanks so much for listening.
This is an ad by BetterHelp. What's your perfect night? Is it curling up on the couch for a cozy, peaceful night in? Therapy can feel a bit like that, your comfort place where you replenish your energy. With BetterHelp, get matched with a therapist based on your needs, entirely online. It's convenient and suited to your schedule. Find comfort this season with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com.